We'll open the committee meeting. And first on, our agenda today is one of the things I'd like to see us do much more often, and that's the follow-up of a legacy. Program, and this was a terrific grant, and we've had her talk little bits and pieces about it because we keep putting her at the end of a meeting and we run out of time, and so now we put her at the beginning of the meeting, so we'll apologize to the next people for running out of time. Hopefully we'll be okay. But this is Mary Vogel, who works in the at the University of Minnesota, and this is the work that she did with a legacy grant. And so I think it's terrific information and statistics for us. And what I really want to do, and you know, particularly you newish legislators, of which there are a couple here, you know, we often ask for reports because it's something easy to do instead of make a decision, and we often don't go back and look at the report said and then try and act on what the report said, or try and at least hear and analyze what the report said. So here, this is a very detailed report that was initially funded by legacy funds, and we have Mary Vogel, who will introduce herself to explain it. And we do have lots of publications from this. We do have in our packets, each person has an in-color print of the summary parts of the report that Ms. Vogel will tell us about. Ms. Vogel.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. My name is Mary Vogel. I'm co-director of the Center for Changing Landscapes, an interdisciplinary research and outreach center in the College of Design in the Department of Forest Resources at the University of Minnesota. I'm here to pick up on what we were talking about a couple weeks ago. Our project was named MNPAT, Minnesota's Network of Parks and Trails, and we're creating information for contextualized decision-making about parks and trails in the state of Minnesota. Our work is informed by design thinking and social science analysis. Our goal was to inform park and trail decisions, including planning and funding decisions like legacy funds, bonding, but also state, regional, and local budgets. We created data that was easy to understand, visual, and spatial. So you could see where people and facilities are, and you could see the state and regional implications of a proposed project. We used a systems thinking approach to inform thinking about how does an individual piece add to the network, and how can investments be most effective? We know that not all acreage acquisitions are alike, nor are all facilities enhancements equal. Our inventory and framework informs and supports the Parks and Trails plan that you heard presented by the DNR 2 weeks ago. And to give you an example of how that works, I'm going to tick off the four pillars that plan came off of. The first one is taking care of what we have. The inventory and framework documented what we have. The second one was connecting people to the outdoors. We documented demographic trends, regional recreational trends, and we identified gaps in the people being served and the recreational experiences being sought. Thank you for this. The third pillar was acquiring land and creating opportunities. And we documented what was in the pipeline and also what were the gaps in facilities and the distribution of facilities. The fourth pillar was coordinate among partners. Our information is local to federal, and we also created some suggestions for wider partnerships within and among legacy funds and also other connections, for example, connections to MnDOT, et cetera. This project was done by an interdisciplinary team. There were 11 of us working on this project. Last time, I quickly presented a lot of the physical data, and some of the reports are there that can be passed around, which focused on federal to local parks and trails and recreation areas, forests, wildlife management areas, and scientific and natural areas. But today I'm going to emphasize the social science dimension and then take you back and remind you about some of the synergies that we suggest could exist among parks and trails in the state.
I can interrupt you for a moment. We do have a quorum present, so I'll formally call the meeting to order. And Representative Lilly, having very carefully read the minutes, will move the adoption of the minutes of March 5th. And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. The minutes are adopted. And let me also make a comment. I know you guys have a bunch of paper in your folder. The one that Ms. Vogel's speaking from now kind of looks like this. And that had the... This has the slides that she's giving us right now. And then at some point... This is a much better one because, as you see, a lot of her stuff depends on colors, and this one is reproduced in color. Mm-hmm. So these are the two things that we're looking at right now. Okay, Ms. Vogel.
We also have some copies of some of the reports on the end of that we passed around last time if people want to look at them again. So we are focusing on the social science work. We looked at the social demographic context for park and trail decision making, and that had included persons per square mile, age groups and where they're located, income groups. We also looked at recreation participation, people that bike, camp, etc. And then we also looked at experiences sought, people recreate to seek solitude. Some want to be in nature with their families. Others want to challenge themselves. You can see that these, what we did was we looked at what the statewide average was and then looked at five regions of the state. Those five regions are old DNR regions, and we were compelled to use those regions because that was where the survey data was collected. And that has caused some challenges, and we can talk a little bit about that later. We also looked at recreation facilities and use and people using a metric called the Recreation Location Quotient, RLQ. The RLQ measures the relative difference in regional recreational characteristics. It is a planning tool intended to help decision makers allocate resources in a way that is more transparent and defensible and fair.
And if I can interrupt a minute, point out the RLQ has a separate sheet for itself. That's this single sheet that you've got.
Then more conventional assessments like acres per person or miles per person. The RLQ has been used in Wisconsin by both academics and DNR folks, and it is a purely descriptive tool that provides a metric for regional comparisons of recreation opportunity supply. you can see from this diagram, this slide, that there are great differences within the state of Minnesota if you look at it from an RLQ perspective. For example, if you were to take a look at just all the resources statewide, now in using this tool, the state is number one. Is one, and the regions have a score based on the formula that you all have in your packets. So, for example, in resources, the state average is number one. One of the regions has 2.5 score. Another region has 0.1. If we look at it from the point of view of trails. Summer trails, we broke them up into summer and winter. One region has 1.69 score. Remember, state is one. And one region has 0.6. Now, if we take the same regions and look at them from a population-based perspective, adjusted for regional demand, that means tourism. One of our researchers who led this study, Ingrid Snyder, is head of the Tourism Center at the university, along with Mae Davenport, who's a professor in the Forest Resources. Anyway, if we look at our population, we have a span of 2.88 to 0.15. We also looked at developed an RLQ by looking at the ecological sections, because part of the role of parks and trails in the state, or parks in Minnesota, is to preserve representative landscapes. And if you look at the recreations by ecological sections, one section has 3.28 score, while another one has 0.5 score. The difference in trails is not quite as dramatic, 0.49 plus to 4.74. But the point here is that these are indications of disparity across the state and could help inform investments in parks and trails and other natural resource investments. In conclusion to my formal presentation, I wanted to go back to examples of widening the dimensions of what we consider when we think about parks and trails in the state of Minnesota. I think we should also think about parks and trails as they relate to preserving representative landscapes, as you just saw on this slide. Some of our ecological sections have good representation, and others have very thin. So here's a measure and a way of thinking about where we put habitat. And habitat can also... But parks and trails can contribute to habitat preservation. They can be adjacent to WMAs and SNAs. They also can provide wildlife corridors. A second widening dimension that could be considered is really thinking about parks and trails in relationship to cultural heritages. Preserving historic sites is part of DNR's mandate, and we have many wonderful historic landmark buildings and structures that were built by the WPA CCC groups in the 30s that are in our parks. They're really compelling structures. The third dimension is that we should consider some places that have many recreation facilities but not public recreation facilities. For example, if you think about Douglas County, that's the Alexandria area, we can think about how many resorts there are, how many cabins there are, how many lake homes there are, but there are few public places in Douglas County. And the fourth suggestion for identifying opportunities is to see how our parks and trails fit into our transportation decisions. I think I mentioned last time that we made an analysis of the metropolitan area in terms of its access to its parks. And the metropolitan area has, for example, many, many wonderful regional parks, but you can't get there unless you have a car. So we have been planning in the metropolitan area transportation here and parks and trails here, and they're not very well integrated. You can take the Hiawatha LRT and walk down the hill to the Fort Snelling State Park, but that's about it. And even when there are bus routes, they don't run on weekends and when places would recreate. In the fifth example is, again, there is a real opportunity to create synergies among systems. And I think I showed you this slide last time. I think the North Shore is the poster child for our wonderful natural resource treasures that we have in this state. We also have a lot of parallel systems that run along the North Shore. So part of our suggestion is to really look more carefully about how to integrate facilities on the North Shore, because taking care of what we have could not only include adding facilities to state parks, but making investments in local parks and trails so they could serve regional and state recreational functions. There are a series of places on the North Shore that could be enhanced to make more interesting places. They could serve state bike trails, hiking trails, water trails, and scenic byways at the same time. They could also have environmental strategies that will improve the environmental quality of these environments. And a number of these environments have a cultural dimension that need to be celebrated. It's not moving. I was going to show you a slide of Beaver Bay. I mentioned it last time. Beaver Bay is a place where a scenic byway, a Gitche-Gami trail.
Is there some problem with that not?
Yeah, it's just not going.
Okay.
Beaver Bay is a place where a local visitor center, a parking lot that was used to sell used cars and wood, firewood, is now been designed and is now being funded by the Federal Highway Administration. And there's going to be a scenic byway, Gitche-Gami trailhead, John Bear Grease celebration, and an ecological strategy to improve the degraded Beaver Riverbank is all going to be folded into one. This is so this will provide and a trailhead for the Superior Hiking Trail all in one. So here's an example of aggregating facilities. You cut acquisition costs, you cut maintenance costs, and you make much more interesting places. And here's an example of a city park in New Ulm that was redesigned as a state trailhead, both for the state water trail and the Minnesota State Terrestrial Trail. We redesigned it so that the parking is taken away from the river, and rain gardens are put between the parking lot and the river. And the river bank is stabilized with native plants because it's a highly erodible plant system. And then we're suggesting that the historic grade school building that is there, that is now an environmental facility, be further developed for by putting a deck on it so you could have performance space. So here's an example of a city park that could be enhanced to create a trailhead rather than buying a new piece of land outside of town and developing. This is a much more interesting and dynamic space. So that is the end of my formal presentation. I appreciate the opportunity to come back for my encore, and I am certainly open to a lot of questions.
Okay. Are there specific questions for Ms. Vogt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little more history about this study. How much was invested in this study?
This study cost $400,000.
And over what period of time was that?
We started in August of 2009, and we delivered the product as required on January 15th, 2011, and then we concluded it at June 30th, 2011.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And how has this study been utilized by the various state agencies?
Well, the DNR has used the material to develop its strategic plan. MnDOT has used it to develop the Minnesota trail that they used. People are using it right now to address some of the issues around fracking in terms of, you know, where the trucks should go and where they shouldn't go. This is not only a resource for the state of Minnesota. We made it a resource for everyone, and Ramsey County has used it. There are a number of counties in the state that have used it. Some of them started using it even before we finished doing the report, because our data was something that was helpful to them in making decisions within their county and also making some inter-county partnerships.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what are the plans for updating the plan, or the study, I should say?
We would like to be able to update it because there are some challenges. Well, first of all, we did interpolate and estimate populations because we did not have the opportunity of using the 2010 census data. Of course, because the report was due the 15th of January 2011. That's number one. Number two, there are some challenges on using the kind of regional analysis that we used. We were forced into the regional analyses because that was what the social science data was collected in, and it was collected in DNR regions. And since that survey data was collected, the DNR has reorganized two times. And so we organized the physical data around counties, and would recommend that we need to organize the social science data that is collected in the future around counties so that it can be aggregated into a region, because, for example, in the South, the southern region of the old southern region of the DNR went from border to border, and the characteristics of southwestern Minnesota are substantially different than the characteristics of southeastern Minnesota, and so if you study them in one region you do not get the clear picture that you need in terms of indicating what the LRQs are and what some of the demographics are. The most reliable of all of the regions is the metro region, because that is by county. It's an aggregate of seven counties. So we would recommend that. That's one recommendation we would make. We would also recommend that there's an enormous difference in ability across the state for local governments to use this material just because there's enormous difference in resources. When we were working with the counties, there was one county that didn't even have an answering machine that we could go to. So we would like to transform some of this data, some of the physical data maps, into maps that can be updated by locals so that it's easier to keep current. Creating this database was an enormous challenge, the biggest challenge that any of us who worked on it, 11 of us, had ever had. Data was not in good shape except in the metropolitan area. There was good data, but we really had to. The federal data was not in good shape. The state data was not in good shape.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you identify regional parks? What did you identify as regionally significant? And if so, what criteria did you use to identify those? And how many did you find in Greater Minnesota?
We used the previous studies that had been identified through DNR studies as regionally significant, with the exception of a couple that we did add because we felt that they met the definition. But we weren't in the definition business, and I think that's one of the issues that we have to face in talking about data is, you know, who the definition of regionally significant.
No.
Also, just to add, one of the reasons that I included the New Ulm slide in this presentation is this is a city park. And in the definition of regionally significant, upgrading this park is not a regionally significant park, but it could make a significant contribution to a regionally significant trail, the Minnesota River State Trail. So I think there are areas that we need to discuss, and some public policy decisions need to be made. We create information and point out opportunities. We don't make public policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the number of regional parks that you identified?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, I do not have that off the top of my head, but it was the number that had been identified by previous studies. George Orning did one, I think, in 2007. There were several studies on regional parks previously.
One of the points, I don't know if you made this point earlier, but one of the problems that we had with this data is looking at, I hate to criticize DNR without giving them a chance to answer that, but when you look at their regions and you set up a region that goes across the whole southern part of the state, and you think of the difference between the natural resources at the western, just natural features of the state at the western part and the eastern part, has Lanesboro, the Root River Trail, all of that stuff. I mean, to say that that's going to be one region is something that's a little hard for me to do. Maybe you guys can figure it out. So I don't know if you've made that point, but.
Madam Chair, yes, we found that was very challenging. that the kind of information that we needed is not as effective if we have a southern region that runs from the Mississippi River to the South Dakota border. And so one of the reasons that I'm suggesting that we need to really think about what is the building block for our data. And that Wisconsin uses the county, and we chose the county for the maps for the reason that we created data that was a political unit that could be then aggregated. So if you wanted to create a 5-county or a 10-county or a 7-county region, you could.
Is that finished? Okay. Representative Erdahl.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Vogel, I was just kind of wondering, for clarity's sake, do these various evaluations directly compare similar park and the trail facilities, like comparing regional parks and trails in greater Minnesota with regional parks and trails in the metro area, or are they just kind of all lumped together in the comparison?
We tried to be as detailed as we could in terms of inventorying facilities. The RLQ does not deal with qualitative, just quantitative measures. One of the reasons that we thought it was important to both have the framework and the inventory is because we wanted people to have access to information to make more qualitative decisions.
Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Vogel, did you state that another study is anticipated by the University of Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative McCarthy?
McDonald.
Okay. I do not anticipate another study by the university, but I think we learned a lot from this study, and that we, at the time in which the study was commissioned, and we were asked to do it by the legislature, we knew that we were not going to be able to use current census data, for one thing, and we also realized that there were challenges using the old DNR districts, regions. So we did indicate that there should be not a new study, but that updating this study, learning from what we learned doing the study, and perhaps changing the rules of how surveys are created and how data is manipulated. I don't mean manipulated by us, but by generated, I should say, that we could build on this project. It's more an updating rather than a new study.
Okay. Madam Chair, I just was going to hook my wagon to Representative Torkelson's questions just regarding that, because when you were here before us, in addition to your testimony, also was the DNR testimony, and they shared with us their plan, their 25-year plan. So, and then I asked you the question at that particular meeting here, that if those two plans were duplicative in their nature, in their scope of the project, which you stated they were not. So I had House Research do a little research and look as to what the legislature instructed the University of Minnesota and the DNR to do. And it just sounds like in updating the plan seems to be duplicative based upon the framework and the scope of the project initially by the legislature. So obviously, as a member of the committee, knowing that it cost the money that it did to produce, my ears perked up when you said that you might be interested in expanding the project or updating it, and of course knowing that there was two studies done very similar, I just want to ensure that again we're not duplicating some of the scope of the project that you already had started and finished at a tune of the $400,000. Does that make sense?
Madam Chairman, Representative McDonald. Yes. Well, we did not duplicate what the DNR did. We supported their work with information. And what we're suggesting is the updating of our work would make our information more updated rather than changing the plan. And I also want to emphasize that this was something that has never been done before in the whole country. It's a marvelous tool for planning. The feds are using it. The state is using it. Local folks are using it. So ours is information and data. The DNR's is a plan. Different.
question.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yeah, I did. I do recognize that, and I did see the project of what the DNR did and the University of Minnesota. There are some areas that they do overlap, and but I see yours was you definitely had two different systems, and it did satisfy my curiosities as to the duplication. And it is obvious that there were some similarities, but not a lot in the two studies. But rest assured, I think we need to be careful when updating, you know, when you did just spend this kind of money in a plan, we want to be careful that that it doesn't cost too much in updating.
I agree with you.
Well, Representative Murphy.
Just one question on that. Everybody that's using it, is the data copyrighted?
The data is the property of the state of Minnesota. It's not copyrighted. It was designed to be used by everybody, and I mean that was one of our major goals, was to empower decision making on all levels.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? I advise people to take this. There's a lot of information in this thing that we've put out in your folders, and I advise you to keep it and incorporate it into some of our thinking as we go along. And thanks. When was the DNR, what was the route for the DNR's plan? Was that funded in last year? Was that, what was the...
The two things were funded at the same time.
Oh, okay.
The legislation required that we work with the DNR, okay, which we did, and the Metro Council and Explore Minnesota Tourism. So it was a joint effort, but different responsibilities.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I think this was a less rushed presentation and helpful to us. Okay. Next on our agenda, we're dealing with the Historic Preservation Corps. Mr. Hogberg. So we're now shifting. We're shifting to historical stuff. Okay. For the rest of the meeting. Okay, Mr. Hogberg.
Get our slides. For technology. Thank you for the opportunity to come to the committee. My name is Rolf Hagberg with the Northern Bedrock Conservation Corps. I'm the executive director. We're a new corps that has started in the last few years, and we are working with the Minnesota Historical Society to...
Just a sec. Point out to members, this is the... maybe you guys don't get confused as easily as I do, but this is the thing that we're working from.
We're working with the Minnesota Historical Society on a proposal to create a Historic Preservation Corps. Our presentation overview today will talk a little bit about the history of conservation corps and Northern Bedrock. We'll also talk about the background of how we have gotten to this point, and then presently where we're at working on the historical with Minnesota Historical Society on the proposal.
I know.
My name is Rolf Hagberg. We will also have two other presenters today, Janet Timmerman with the Center for Olmsted History, Center for Olmsted County, and Larry Sommer, who's a historic preservation consultant. Conservation Corps history, of which many of you have an understanding of, is a great model and a great model to get things done. There are some statistics on the left side of the sheet about the number of people employed. Down on the bottom, it talks about over 4,000 historic structures that were restored, which is a huge thing. Not only did the CCC build a lot of buildings, they restored a lot of buildings. On the right side, Conservation Corps today, there are over 150 Conservation Corps in the country. In the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a real growth in terms of nonprofits that are more regional and specialty type corps. What we're proposing is to create a specialty corps that would specifically deal with historic preservation. Many states have many corps. Colorado has 7, Washington has 10, California 22. My background is with a variety of corps. In 1976, I was a camp director of a youth conservation corps camp. I also worked.
I thought you were going to tell us you had been in the CCC.
No.
Close.
We skipped a generation there.
Okay. There used to be Harmon Ogdahl, who was the state's, in the days so far away that Minnesota actually had Republican senators from the city of Minneapolis. And Harmon Ogdahl was a Republican senator, and we were on tour looking at various things, some of the things that were made, and he had been in the CCC, and we were looking at a project that he had helped build. He was now some big-shot corporate lawyer and a Republican, but he had been in the CCC. So,
thank you for that. CCC is a great legacy to all of us. I worked in the Youth Conservation Corps and then was a camp director in the Young Adult Conservation Corps, then focused much energy on the Minnesota Conservation Corps when it transitioned and was created in 1981. I was on the governor's Youth Corps Advisory Committee for many years, and then we created a nonprofit. We knew that eventually the fit with DNR would change, and 10 years ago I worked to move the Minnesota Conservation Corps into the new nonprofit and stayed with them as a staff person for many years, worked with Len Price and many of the great staff over there for a long time. I visited with Len this morning. He's totally supportive of having a historic preservation corps. This is a niche that the Minnesota Conservation Corps is not interested in developing, and it's more opportunity for youth and young adults to get involved in workforce development and creative things. So it's great to have a niche that we can work in. We created Northern Bedrock a few years ago to provide Conservation Corps experiences to fill unmet needs. In getting involved with the Halfway Ranger Station site near Ely, we have now gotten excited about being a historic preservation corps. The Halfway Ranger Station, just to talk a little about this, and this could be one of the pilot projects as we move forward, is a it's on the National Register of Historic Places. The Forest Service has wanted to bulldoze these beautiful buildings since 2006. We have stepped in the middle of that, working with the SHPO office and many concerned citizens and groups to create a feasibility study with some of the some of it was funded through legacy funds through the SHPO office. We have submitted that feasibility study. The Forest Service has stopped the bulldozers and is interested in working with us to explore ideas of creating that. In the process, of trying to save this site. We've learned about the Colorado Historic Corps model, which they has been around for a number of years. Historic Corps is a nationally known historic preservation corps where they work with volunteers and crews to work on buildings all over the country. We've met with them. Here's a historic corps example. This is a crew member that's doing some roofing, looks like Cedar Shakes. You can see by this picture that they come with the safety equipment, the harnesses, the scaffolding, and all those different things. So that's just one project. A lot of repair and maintenance to these structures. This is another project through Historic Corps where they've straightened up this log building and they're replacing some logs that on the inside of it. Many of their projects are done by volunteers, and some are done by crews. With that in mind, we created a real informal advisory group. This fall, we made a lot of calls, and a lot of people interested in coming to a meeting. Some at this meeting, we explored many different topics, and this is what we learned when we came out of the meeting, that the amount of historic preservation field work is overwhelming, that a lot of the work is maintenance and repair and really good crew type and volunteer type work. It's not necessarily all the highly technical things that may be needed. There is a need on these work sites to have the historic preservation technical specialist that would be there to make sure that any of the technical work is done right, but also to ensure that many times the Section 106 standards are followed. Trade skills that could be learned by crews hold the potential for future careers and are needed skill sets. The beauty of a Conservation Corps model is that potentially different programs could involve youth, could involve young adults. If they're involved in AmeriCorps, they can earn some education awards to go to college and eventually work in the trades of historic preservation. And the historic preservation community assures us that there's a continued need for talented people to grow into those fields and to work with the tradesmen and the corporations and the unions that are already there working on that. This is a diagram that kind of an evaluation worksheet. There seems to be a variety of different types of technical things, from probably just cutting the brush and digging a little ditch around the side of the building to get the water to not run into it, to all the way up to full rehabilitation and preservation. And one of the things that we're real interested in this proposal is to have a thorough evaluation of the different types of projects that crews and corps could fit into, and then all of the different program components and needs. It's a more complicated structure than a typical Conservation Corps program, and it is but a real needed one. And this, we from the information we learned, we put this sheet together to help us and guide us. It's kind of a draft. The proposal that we're working with the Minnesota Historical Society would be a two-year proposal. The first phase one would be collecting input from the advisory group and different types of project hosts and a whole variety of people that could have input into this. And then we would have a field season where we would have some crews available, and we would do a variety of crew type projects and volunteer projects. These would be pilot projects that would give us an understanding of where we need to train and the types of capabilities that we'd need to have involved. We'd do another season or another winter of evaluation and planning, and then a partial second field season. There's our crews would be funded crews, but would work with the project host to do a cost sharing. So, and all that would still need to be put together, but it would be a valuable way and a cost saving way to get more of this work that's sitting on the sidelines done. These pilot projects that we were working on might come in all sizes and shapes, but one of them that we have talked about is with Janet Timmerman, who's the interim director of the Historic History Center of Olmsted County, and these are slides of her pilot project. This would just be kind of an example of some of the things and the value of having a core do that. So I'd like to introduce Janet at this point.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Please say your name for the table.
My name is Janet Timmerman. I'm the interim director of the History Center of Olmsted County. And I became interested in this. Our Historical Society became interested in this project. I'm a past core member from the 1990s when it was called the Minnesota Conservation Corps. My son was part of the Minnesota Conservation Corps, spent a summer at St. John's as a youth corps member and then also as a young adult corps member. So when Rolf brought the idea of a historic corps to us, I could envision how it could play out. And at the History Center of Olmsted County, the Historical Society has been in place since 1926. We have been at our present site since about 1972. We have 46 acres on the southwest corner of Rochester. We have some beautiful million-dollar homes that look over our two little farm sites out there where our museum sits and our 1856 George Stoppel farmstead, which is what you see a picture of up there on the screen. This little farmstead sits on the northern edge of our 46 acres, and we just received back this beautiful study, which is a historic structure report for that farmstead. And this was created through an arts and cultural heritage grant, through the legacy grant. This was our first step when we talk about what our new envisioning process is for this farmstead. So this little farmstead was built out of local sandstone by the George and Maria Stoppel family. They came from Germany in the 1840s and settled at the edge, which was way out of town, in 1856, 2 years before Rochester was even incorporated as a town. This farmstead is intact. The buildings that sit there now are the ones that were built in the 1850s and 60s, and our envisioning process is to preserve them and then create a wonderful community asset from them, something that the community will be proud of and utilize in the future. And part of our vision includes the possibility of a historic corps. Because this site was the site of an early family that created their own self-sufficiency, this was both a sustainable market farm. It was a dairy. They had their own vineyard. They had their own brewery. They relied on themselves, and we want to include that as part of our mission for this site. Self-sufficiency and sustainability has to be part of our theme when we start to think about how we're going to utilize it. First, we have to preserve it and fix it up. And we thought of this one structure, which is a very unique piece of vernacular architecture on site. It's one little building that had lots of uses. The staff calls it the smokehouse. And it did indeed have a smokehouse tacked onto the side of it where you see that chimney on the side. But it was a smokehouse. It also was the entry to a 65-foot cave, which is behind it. There was a woodworking shop on the side of it, which we think was probably a cooperage, where a barrel maker worked, because George's trade was a cooper. It also has an outhouse on one side. And then on the top, which makes it a very unique little structure, is the fact that there's an Eastern European-style bell tower with an onion dome at the top. And the upstairs of this, the downstairs was used as a machine shop and woodworking shop, and the upstairs of this was used to house indentured servants, because George and Maria Stoppel came here with money from Cincinnati. They came from Germany, made their money in Cincinnati, and then came to this little farmstead of 160 acres with the means to start a farm. And they brought other German immigrants over, and they became the farmhands on the farm. So that was a living quarters up there. What makes this a wonderful opportunity for a historic corps is the fact that there are so many skills to be learned on this. Part of our mission at the History Center is education, and education about the skills that created this place would be a marvelous part of our mission. As you can see on the back, it's got some very severe problems with roofing and framing. Over time, a lot of trees that overhung that building created problems with the roof. So it needs to have new shingles. It needs to have new roof framing. There's also beams in the underside that need to be replaced. What is really a wonderful tie for us is that on site we have a group of men and women called the Mechanical History Roundtable. And these people have all kinds of skills as to how to saw and cut and create beams that fit with the original structure, because we have an on-site sawmill and an on-site shingle mill. So those skills are already there, and we could share those with whatever group comes to help us put this together. We have local stonemasons that we've worked with in the past. You can see a picture of the cave, mouth of the cave, and some of the structural problems that we have there. Learning how to remove joists and replace joists and do the stonework also that's needed. There's some of the stonework and a picture of that cave that goes back into the side of the hill. That's a naturally carved cave. Part of it's been laid up, and part of it is just carved out of the stone. There are three caves on this farm place, two of which need to be renovated. And the last is metalworking. We also have a working tinsmith on our site, and people who are used to working with that type of metalwork, which is a skill that isn't used very much anymore. So we have a lot of the teachers, the expertise, and the local resources to help make something like this happen. What's interesting about this little building is that unique onion dome at the top, and we're not quite sure where that came from, but it's there and it needs repair, and we have the people to help Historic Corps put it together. When we talk about local funding and how we might pair with a Historic Corps, we have gone to several different sources in the past to preserve parts of this farmstead, and we would probably approach them as well. The charm of this pairing is that it has everything to do with educating a new population in skills that are fast disappearing. And so that's why we were excited when Ralph came to us with the possibility of a plan like this. And with that, I would ask if there were any questions of me. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Madam Chair, well, I need to introduce
Let me go to Mr. Summer in a minute. Representative Hausman has a question, so we'll get to that question.
Madam
first.
Chair, and perhaps you're just interested in, like, I see woodwork, stonework, metalwork, but as I look at the 1856 photo and today, Do we also recreate the surroundings? I mean, what looks like an orchard that seems to fit the place, shouldn't we have an orchard today? And is that part of the work of historic restoration?
Madam Chair and Member Houseman, certainly. This is just one small piece of the whole vision for the Stoppel Farmstead. They did have an orchard in the front. They had hops, and they had 160 acres of farm crops. Part of that is also restoring a landscape that has disappeared. You're correct.
And then, Madam Chair, just from their slide, what we learned from the advisory group. I mean, this is, I think any time we invest in the historic preservation, we always ask ourselves, how much can we afford to preserve? And so then how do we determine, how do you determine what is worthy of preservation? And I'm certain that must have been part of the conversation.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hogberg. And
Representative Houseman. The advisory group was really a great selection of a variety of educational people, private consultants, and governments and people that own these historic sites. Our role as a historic preservation core would be to work on projects that are primarily shovel ready. So that means that the historic reports and that the identifying of with SHPO of what needs to happen and all of those things have shifted to a point where now they have that structure report and that study, and they're ready to put the new roof on, or they're ready to do those things. So although we may have, as we get into this, we'll gather more, and we'll have more of an understanding of how all those things play out, is that we're really leaving all those kind of decisions to the experts, and hopefully providing a cost-effective labor force that also has an educational value to work on.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifiers. So, are you anticipating?
We do have one more testifier.
So. Well,
more.
Sorry, I can just ask. I'll just keep going.
Yeah.
I assume this is for educational purposes, for like school groups. Is that the main intent? Or what type of groups are you looking
at? Madam Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Hogberg.
Representative Rudolph, traditionally conservation corps have a variety of age groups involved. What we're thinking about starting on the front end, it would be young adults. It could involve local education programs too, but the crews that we would have would be young adults. There's an opportunity to also have possibly a summer youth program. Those are many times more residential. There could be a local core that would do that. We're really on the front end of thinking about this. The model that we are following and like is this historic core model out of Colorado, and they work primarily with adult groups of volunteers and crews from conservation corps type programs.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. And that was good information for me to know. But my question, actually, I probably should have gone with Ms. Timmerman. Once it's done, who do you expect to come to this?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl. Our hope is that this historic farmstead becomes a spot that teaches sustainable skills to all ages. We certainly do cater to school children, all the way from preschoolers to college students. In fact, in a couple of days, we're doing RCTC tours out at the History Center. We would like to teach learners of all ages here, and it could be anything from learning how to preserve your own food to learning tinsmithing skills or how to raise your own chickens, things that teach a sense of sustainability and self-sufficiency. So we have learners from all ages that we work with.
Madam Chair?
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you. And I'm sorry if I missed this earlier, but who actually owns this?
Madam Chair, Representative Rudolph, the History Center of Olmsted County owns this site, this 10 acres. And we are a nonprofit. We are a county historical society, but we are our own nonprofit.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Ms. Timmerman, and would you then be you would be operating and maintaining it once it were finished?
Ms. Timmerman?
That is correct. We'd be operating as a part of our mission to preserve and educate.
Okay. Mrs. Summer, I assume you have something. Or do you get introduced by somebody, or do we just call on you yourself?
We'd like to introduce Larry Summer. He's a historic preservation consultant and a long experienced historic preservation professional.
Mr. Summer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lawrence Summer, S-O-M-M-E-R. Currently live in St. Paul, but am a longtime resident and worked in Duluth for many years. Representative Murphy, good to see you. And my background has been in the historic preservation field and museum business for a long, long time, both here in Minnesota as well as in Montana and Nebraska. I've run large historical organizations and have been a state historic preservation officer. And for many, many years also worked with architecture firms and others on historic preservation projects throughout many different states and things. I'm here today simply to support the concept and the proposal to establish a Historic Preservation Corps program in Minnesota that probably would be patterned after the successful Historic Corps program in Colorado. I think the previous speakers have talked at some length about the issues, and I'll just reiterate and summarize, I think, some of the key points. There's certainly a need for a program like this. Within Minnesota, there are hundreds of publicly owned historic structures that are owned by the state, local units of government, county and local historic organizations. As we all know, if we visited our county and local historical societies or our parks and things, there's a constant ongoing need for maintenance and repairs to assure the continued long-term preservation of these important resources. There's also a lack of trained craft and tradespeople who have the knowledge and skills to work on historic vernacular kinds of structures. So the purpose of this program is basically threefold. One, it provides an opportunity to train people who want to work in the historic preservation trades field. The program, once it gets going, would create a pool of trained workers to undertake repairs and maintenance projects that would help assure the continued preservation and good stewardship of publicly owned vernacular structures in Minnesota. And finally, it would also provide career training in a field in which there is a growing need and demand. So as a longtime museum and historic preservation professional and state historic preservation officer, I urge your favorable consideration of this project. And I also would be happy to answer any questions. So,
are there questions?
Thank you.
For Mr. Summer? Ms. Murphy?
Mr. Summer, could you please tell us what vernacular architecture is?
Generally, the kinds of buildings that we're talking about here, this farmstead, a barn, a rural barn, a log structure, things like that, typically buildings that aren't designed by architects would be one good definition. You know, in rural, you see them, you know, we had in St. Louis County, we had the Wharton and Finish farmstead that the County Society owned, and certainly places like this and a lot of the rustic park structures and things. You know, obviously some of the more important ones and some of the major parks that were designed by architects. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we do have one more person that we'd like to get to, so thank you very much. Very interesting presentation.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. David Keller, you're going to tell us how this all fits together? And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. Just a quick word about how this fits in, particularly with the funding area. You'll recall that a few weeks ago we came before you on behalf of the Minnesota History Coalition, which is a group of 9 organizations that came together to come up with a common recommendation on funding, a request for funding. The structure that the History Coalition recommended is very, very similar to the structure that Representative Murphy and Representative Erdahl have used over the past 2 biennia, and that is to have a grants program, a partnership program, and a statewide historical activities program primarily run by the Minnesota Historical Society. The proposal you just heard from the group, as they mentioned, we've spent a great deal of time with them trying to develop it and making sure that it fits into historic preservation standards, et cetera. That would certainly fit very well into the partnership category or the grants category. And in fact, the Stoppel Farm, as Ms. Timmerman mentioned, received a legacy grant for the historic structures report. So I just wanted to make a quick mention and quick reminder of the recommendation that we brought forward to you a few weeks ago on a structure that's been in place for 2 biennia that's worked quite well. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any of these vernacular buildings on county fairgrounds?
I'm sure there are, but I'm not sure that, Madam Chair, if anyone's done a complete survey of those buildings, but there could very well be.
Maybe. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's possible that under this section, maybe I'll get the answer to an earlier question I had. When it says $1 million for a statewide survey of historical and archaeological sites that will identify and preserve location, structures, and artifacts of statewide historical, archaeological, and cultural significance, is that where we decide which ones we're going to preserve? Is that the point?
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, that's part of that picture, and I'm looking over to my right. Scott Anfinson, who's the state archaeologist, is in the room today, and he's been working very closely. He's one of the 3 agencies that is involved with that survey. The idea of a survey is to have a look across the state at what you have, and there are obviously many, many archaeological resources. That's where we started. On the historic side, we've looked at various themes. Right now, the group is undertaking a survey of dams across the state to take a look at historic dams and see what's worth preserving and what's not. There are literally thousands of entries on the National Register of Historic Places already, and thousands more that we need to learn more about. Going back to your question of the group with the Stoppel Farm, what they will decide to preserve on that farm is based on solid scholarship. They did a historic structures report. That will inform the next process of how they preserve that, what's historic and what's not, and how they preserve that based on the standards that are out there. So there's a large world of what I think your question is getting at. How do we decide with all the historic structures that are out there, how do we decide what to preserve and what not to preserve? It's not a orderly process. It's kind of a messy process based on ownership and funding availability, and we would like to save all historic structures, but that's not possible based on funding that's out there. So based on historical significance and a will to do the work are large factors.
Okay. Anyone else in the committee?
Thank you.
Representative Murphy. Don't go yet.
Madam Chair, members, one of the things that intrigued me from the beginning about this Historical Preservation Corps and what Ms. Hammersman said was that they have knowledge of, or they have people that have knowledge and skills that your local builder doesn't have, or local people in the community often don't know who to go to for expertise on how to preserve or how to do the old-time welding for a fence, or to do the skilled kind of work that was done 100 or 200 years ago. We don't do it that way anymore. And too often we, you know, duplicate like crown molding kind of thing, when maybe we should be doing the real stuff, or at least know how the real stuff was done. And I just think that there's value in having some skilled people with old-fashioned skills and ways of doing things available somewhere in the state that could be consulted for particular historical projects, or for particular people to be able to approach and say, where do I go to get my windows? Do I go to Anderson or Marvin, or to where do I go to get the windows that will look exactly like what I want and what grandma put in the house kind of stuff? And I think there's a great value of that. And that's why I'd like to consider these ideas that were presented to us today.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any final comments? Any public comments? Any comments from the public? Okay. Okay, well, tomorrow we're going to do the Science Museum and the Duluth Aquarium. And a general remark for everybody, as we were thinking about trying to combine things, when we have a project like this, if anybody knows that there's a trail that we should fund that goes right to it, or a park that we should connect to it, just keep thinking and tell us. Tell us about it. Bring it forward on the list. What? Okay.
You got loose line today.
Yeah.
What's
okay.
Well, you said
meeting adjourned.